Well, just a few weeks ago, right before Pesach, we had the opportunity to speak to Rabbi Leo D. He was with us live via telephone while we were in our Teaneck studio pre-Pesach. This was just around the time when the Hazkarot, the memorial services were taking place for his wife and two daughters, who were, of course, murdered by the enemy Pesach of last year. Appropriately, it was done before the month of Nisan, right toward the end of Adar Bet. And we spoke about what was happening at that time and about the turnout and the reaction from around the world over the last year. And we asked Rabbi D if we could come, when we come to Israel, if we could sit face to face, because those conversations are obviously much more meaningful than being on the telephone. And he graciously agreed. And with that in mind, I say, Rabbi Leo D, a pleasure to welcome you back to JM in the AM.
Okay. Nachum, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you very much. We had speculated, or I asked you to speculate during our last conversation, what this year's Pesach Seder would be like. How did it turn out? What was this year's Pesach Seder like?
Baruch Hashem, my parents were in town. We went, the four of us, to Jerusalem, and we had the Seder with them, and it was surprisingly pleasant. I think that having got the Hazkarah out of the way before Pesach, before Nisan, we were able to focus on the Simcha of Pesach, strangely.
Right. There's a lot of pain in this country, always, not just now, but since October 7th, obviously, it's unfortunately been enhanced, that whole category of pain, something you can relate to because of what your family has gone through. Those of us who are lucky enough to be in regular, normal situations, so to speak, can't even fathom how you've been able to handle everything. With that in mind, how do you view what's happening now in Israel? How does someone like yourself think of the wives, the parents, the families that are suffering because of all the soldiers that have been taken from us by the enemy and all those who have been killed by the enemy over the last few months?
We are suffering the greatest disaster, greatest challenge we've had since the Holocaust, perhaps more violent than the Holocaust in some ways. And the response of the world to this particular tragedy is more severe, perhaps, than the Holocaust, where they, you know, Americans and British pretended they didn't know about it, at least. And now, and at this point, they're dancing in the streets. So, we are certainly in a pit. However, we know from Jewish history that when we go down to the bottom of the pit, we're actually on the verge of gula. And I think that's how I look at it, that, commensurate with the size of the tragedy is the size of the gula that's on its way. And that's what keeps me, hopeful.
In the aftermath of this terrible tragedy, your family, we may have discussed some of this when we were on the phone together before Pesach. There's an attempt by friends and family and those in your community to try to comfort you. Was there anything said to you in the immediate aftermath of this terrible tragedy that you in fact did find comforting, or is it better for people sometimes to be there and be present for you but not necessarily speak anything?
So two things I tell people when they ask me this question. Number one is, I didn't find it helpful when people tried to express their feelings. In fact, I found it very painful. And the best thing that people said to me was, "Ein milim," that there are no words. And that was sufficient, because that expressed the fact that they cared without having to put me through the challenge of listening to how they felt about it. The second thing, a friend of mine told me, I think the name of Cheryl Landsberg or something from Facebook, do not ask, "How are you?" Which seems like a completely perfectly okay sort of greeting, but when somebody's gone through a tragedy, do not ask, "How are you?" You can ask, "How are you today?" Because if you ask, "How are you?" then you're putting the person on the spot, and they want to say fine, but they're not fine, so there's no answer. But if you say, "Well, how are you today?" so they can say, "I'm fine today," with the understanding that, overall, I'm not doing so well.
Wow. Rabbi Leo D is with us. You mentioned on the air with us a few weeks ago that your community specifically, you felt, really embraced you. The day of the funerals, right? Those days where you saw the outpouring of support, of love, of, being enveloped in a certain embrace, right? I guess we could put it that way. Has that remained that way in the last year?
Definitely so. I've got a number of friends who have fixed, you know, hourly slots with me during the week. We call it a chavruta, but basically it's a chat with a little bit of learning over a text. And generally, you know, people invited me for every meal. In fact, the people of Frat offered to make food for us three times a day for the year, which was a lovely idea. But actually, after about a month or so, the kids were looking forward to having some home baked food. So that really, there's no limit to how kind they've been. I've sent it was interesting. We went to visit some of the Be'eri families in the Dead Sea. And sitting there in the hall with 1,000 of them in their kibbutz meeting in the evening, I realized that they hadn't lost, two people from a family of six, but they'd lost two people from a family of 1,000 because, you know, the kibbutz is just like one big family. Right. And I felt that our experience was that we didn't lose three people from a family of seven, but three people from a family of 14 million, because we really felt a huge hug from the whole of Am Yisrael.
All right, not just in Israel, but around the world.
Absolutely.
How many years ago did you make Aliyah?
Originally 20 years ago, and we took 6 years out in the middle in Shlichot in England.
And I don't remember if you told this or not. Was there one in particular between you and your wife who was more anxious to get to Israel, or would you say it was equal?
So my wife woke up in 2009, which we'd been in England for about 6 months or less than a year, in our six-year shlichut, and she said, I had a dream. So I said, okay, what was the dream? She said, I dreamt that the shekel got more expensive than the pound, and the house prices in Israel went up faster than the house price in London, and we couldn't afford to buy a home when we moved back in 5 years' time. So I said, well, what do you want me to do? So she said, we've got to sell our house in London, and we've got to buy a place in Efrat, which was astonishing because she had no idea of house prices and she had no idea of currency fluctuations, but she had this dream. So what could I do? So we sold a house in London in 2009. 2010, February, I was out in Efrat in the new neighborhood of Zayat at the time, looking at every house, four of them that were available. And she stayed behind with five kids under the age of six. And I sent her back by internet pictures and videos of the houses I saw. And she chose the one that she liked. That was in the day before smartphones. Unfortunately, I think I confused some of the pictures. So she was slightly confused when she arrived at the house.
She ended up at the right house.
It wasn't necessarily the right house. But anyway, I tell people that Baruch Hashem, at the time I bought the house, I could have afforded three houses in a frat for the price of one house in London. And today the house in a frat's worth twice the house in London. So it's part of my sort of campaign to tell Americans, don't expect, if you can afford to buy something in Israel today, don't expect that might be true in 6 months' time, right, or even a year.
And it's only going to go up in value. Mm. You spent some time on the Cambridge campus, correct? Am I right about that? Because I read about you, and it was graduate work, I assume? Or was it undergrad work?
In England. Yeah. Yes, I studied chemical engineering.
You see what's happening on college campuses in the United States. Mm-hmm. We always have been under the impression that in places like London, and I'm assuming on campuses around there, mm-hmm. it's already been like that in the past. Am I right or wrong?
So it's never been as visible, but it's always existed. And one of my messages to American Jewish students is that, you know, October the 7th didn't start anti-Semitism. The anti-Semites who you saw on October the 7th are exactly the same anti-Semites who were there on October the 6th. It's just that it wasn't popular to go out and stick a flag up in the air and say, I'm an anti-Semite. So Baruch Hashem, we're in a world now, we can see what we're up against. And
you think that's a good thing?
I think it's a good thing. It's definitely a good thing, because not only we can see it, but the whole world can see it, and they can't deny it. And actually Jews, we're very good at denying it. We pretended it didn't exist.
And what about London in general? Did you feel anti-Semitism just being a resident of the city?
Well, put it this way, in 2014, when we came back after Shlichut, my daughter Maya was on a school trip with her Jewish school. They forgot to tell the boys to wear caps. And they got halfway there to the center of London, and they got abused by, you know, two or three Asian men screaming obscenities, and the teachers canceled the trip and came all the way home. That was 2014.
Yeah. And now that type of activity, as we're seeing in the New York area, is all too commonplace. And, of course, the college campuses you described, I mean, they're just at a level that's hard to believe, at least in the U.S. But again, as you indicated, It's always been like that on the college campuses in Europe as well, just maybe not as blatant.
I think we're honest. It's been like that in college campuses in America.
Right.
It's just, I mean, look at Harvard, for example, I visited. The Hillel rabbi told me that 20 years ago it would have been 25% Jews in Harvard. Today it's 4%. So he used to have 150 people in the Hillel house, you know, number of minyanim. Today he's got 30 and barely scrapes together a minyan.
Right. Was this part of your recent U.S. tour?
This last tour was my fourth since October the 7th.
And this fourth one included just areas of New York and New Jersey or other places as well?
Connecticut.
Oh, Connecticut as well. So you were in a bunch of synagogues.
Baruch Hashem.
And invited to speak and always given a topic, or you always gave them a topic, or they essentially just said, you know what, we're curious about what you have to say and then maybe we'll have some questions to ask you afterwards.
Fortunately, they let me choose the topic because I decided this was my emergency Aliyah trip. So that was the...
Unlike the prior three.
It feels like things are heating up. And it seems to me that every community should have an emergency Aliyah plan. And I suggested that they should start a committee. And on the basis that, you know, at the moment it's not so bad, but it could go either way. Please God, it gets better, in which case they don't need a plan. But if it gets worse, the community should have a plan. We sell the communal building. It's worth $10, $20 million. We can buy a plot of land in Beit Shemesh. We can move how many families to buildings. We can bring Nefesh B'Nefesh in to speak to the community and experts on Jewish schooling and old age homes.
Oh, you're not just preaching about individual families going. You're saying that a community could make it happen for everybody if they do this the right way.
Well, I think the model is the Mir Yeshiva moved from Poland to Mesherim, and Ponovich moved from Lithuania to Bnei Brak. And I can see, you know, Teaneck moving to Teaneck HaChadasha. You know, we talk about New York and New Jersey when we know that New York and Jersey are in England. So why not Teaneck HaChadasha somewhere?
I forgot about that. We borrowed that from the Brits. So I was told the following. Someone showed up in my building, must have been after, not this past Shabbat, but the prior one.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what was the takeaway from your presentation?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, I'll sum it up this way. Someone came over to me knowing that I always struggle with this question of making Aliyah, moving to Israel. And they said, you are going to feel very uncomfortable at this presentation. That was what they said. But I guess, admittedly, it was sort of your intent to make people feel uncomfortable.
It was my intent. In fact, Rabbi Baum at Teaneck. He introduced my Devar Torah on Shabbos morning. He said, before Rabbi D speaks, I want to tell you that he's going to make us all feel very uncomfortable.
So that line had rabbinic endorsement. My gosh. And sure enough, you got up and obviously Aliyah was part of it.
It was interesting. I had three responses. I had a group of people who came and said that was the strongest talk for Aliyah they've ever heard. I had another group of people who said it was very nice, meaning I probably wasn't listening to it. And, you know, it was like a Devar Torah that any other Devar Torah. And then there was a small group who complained to the rabbi that, you know, why did you bring this guy in to abuse us?
And none of those groups surprised you?
Nothing surprised me.
Right.
Yeah, but
you expect those three reactions no matter what.
For sure. The beauty of being a guest speaker is that I don't have to be there next week. So.
Right. But the latter reaction bothers me a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not surprised by it, but it bothers me a bit that, you know, we're Jews.
Mm-hmm.
The future of the Jewish people is in the state of Israel. It's a theme that I've been talking about for decades.
Mm-hmm.
But people refuse to even just acknowledge that.
So there's a resistance. I mean, I started my career as a strategy consultant, and for about 3 years, I was talking to board directors about change in their businesses. And one of the things they taught us about was resistance, that, you know, when you're talking about change, then people come up with all sorts of arguments. So I had, you know, people telling me, you know, the Pnei Yeshua 200 years ago wrote a tshuva that said that every shul is like Eretz Israel, therefore you can make Aliyah by going to shul and things like that, you know, which made me question whether if he'd been alive today, he would have said the same thing, but that, you know, et cetera. And really, when you dug down, it was because they had a very good, comfortable job and comfortable life in America, and they were scared about going to make Aliyah. So they justified it often by bringing, you know, sources from a few hundred years ago, which probably a few hundred years ago were very accurate and very relevant.
And among those who are enthusiastic about your presentation, do you think that based on the way they approached you afterwards, that they were serious about actually making this move?
Look, I think with many important decisions you make in your life, it's a multiple, you know, it's a combination of many people who influence you. Right. So I think that, you know, one talk is not going to change anyone's life, but I think that if, you know, multiple people come and say the same thing from different angles, eventually you figure that's Emmett.
Well, I brought this up only because the rumor was that you hit people over the head with this, that you were, and now you tell me that you went for that purpose, that your whole tour was really focused on this one issue, which is pretty amazing, frankly. I mean, you have a voice now, obviously, through difficult circumstances, quite admittedly, right? I mean, this is, you've been on a crazy road to get here, right?
Yeah.
You would agree with that.
I didn't choose to be here, and you know, I feel like this is my tough key for the short to medium term is to talk about Aliyah, particularly because I see the dangers in American Jewry, and I think that, you know, I'm named after my great uncle Leopold Walitsky, who was the only one of my grandfather's nine siblings who decided to stay in Riga in the 1930s. Everyone else left to Palestine or to London. And he was murdered with his wife and kids in his garden in 1942 by his neighbors. And he was the one who didn't get out because life was comfortable and, you know, life was good and his wife was happy and they had a beautiful house. And I remember Rebbetzin Jungreis, who came to our community in Hendon in 2009, she said, 2009 is 1929 Berlin. And she said, I see all the signs. She said, New York, 1929, she said, people are affluent, people are, you know, great jobs, they're doing very well, and there's this underlying anti-Semitism that you can feel, and this is how it started in Berlin.
And she spent her youth in a concentration camp.
Yeah, and she grew up in 1929 Berlin as well.
Yeah. This is, I'm sure this has crossed your mind 1,000 times as you're doing this. It's an amazing memorial to your wife, because based on the story you told us, she was the dreamer, literally, who said this is the only way to go.
Well, she said many times, she said that, you know, the only place for us to bring up Jewish children is in Israel. She said in Chutz La'aretz, Judaism is a hobby. And in Israel, you know, you live, you work, you shop, and you fight with brothers and sisters. And she was pretty firm about that.
No, no question about it. Rabbi Leo D is with us. We're in Jerusalem. We're live on the air. All right, so you've, again, I mentioned that you've been given this voice, difficult and crazy circumstance, but you have spoken out on a number of issues that I must ask you about, even Aliyah withstanding. You made this, and I wish I had it in front of me, and I apologize, I should have, but you made this very interesting argument, discouraging people from blaming the Haredi community who are generally, I don't want to give, you know, there are some who are, but generally are not part of the IDF, are not part of the movement to be drafted and to go to the Army. And you made the argument that for the benefit of the State of Israel, it might be better this way. Could you explain that?
There's a certain Mesirat Nefesh that Haredi people pursue in Israel. And I'll explain what it is. The average household expenditure of a Haredi family, even given they have on average six kids, is one third of the household expenditure of a, let's say, not yet religious couple with two kids in Tel Aviv, or a Dati Lumi couple in, you know, with four kids. So they live on a very low budget, and that means that they don't have a car usually. They take the bus. They live in a small flat, and the kids, you know, have lots of bunk beds. They don't go to supermarkets. They buy food in bulk, and they split it up. So they have this tremendous Mesirat Nefesh, and they provide a huge amount of children into the Jewish people, into Israel. Just this today, they were talking about the last census of Israel shows that we're actually dropping slightly behind the Arab birth rate. And this is the biggest challenge to the existence of the State of Israel. So they're providing security in terms of numbers. And then people say, and also, by the way, in terms of economy, because the Israeli economy is the most healthy economy in the Western world, because we have a birth rate of on average of 3, compared to Germany that has less than 1.5 and will not be a state within about 15 years because they'll be taken over by immigrants. So they're protecting us for security, but also from an economic point of view, the economy here grows naturally by 1-2% because of birth rate. Then you have Aliyah, then you have innovation. So they're a critical part of that. And then people say, well, yeah, but they're not that useful because they don't actually provide any money to the state or any hands in the army. And that's also not true. Because it turns out that about 20% of the kids go off the derech, the Haredi derech, and might end up as being Dati Lumi or not observant.
And in the workforce.
And they go in the workforce and they go into the army. So if you ask any person in Tel Aviv today, or you ask any person in Efrat, you know, who were your great-great-grandparents, right? They were probably Haredi, I mean, whatever that means. So we see that effectively they are the population providers in the Israeli population. And they provide a very important role. And God forbid we should throw out the baby with the bathwater.
And the psychological element that people, you know, who are serving in the IDF and families who are making that type of sacrifice feel they're being, I don't know, neglected or shortchanged by the fact that the others are not giving that type of investment?
I think that you know, there are many people who are not contributing. I mean, at the RCA conference I was honored to be invited to last week, Rav Herschel Schechter made a beautiful talk, and he was asked the question about what the extent of Milchemet Mitzvah is. And he said that a law student in an American university has the same obligation as any Israeli on living in Tel Aviv. So you know, so it's not just the Haredim who are, you know, not you know, taking the brunt, but there are Jews all over the world, many of whom are very Zionistic, who also.
Believe me, I feel guilty even bringing this up when my own children never served in the army. So yeah, I mean, you're 100% right. Now I am a believer that Jews around the world are, in fact, responsible to go and serve. The only thing I'm saying is that it always seems that the schism that continues to grow, or maybe before October 7th continued to grow, between the ultra-Orthodox and other communities in Israel always seem to never have a good solution.
There's an argument that they should do more national service. Right. I think that most people probably would not want them in the army, certainly for the next, you know, foreseeable future, because they don't perceive them to be, you know, qualified enough. And I think most people would be satisfied they did national service. But I think you have to take into account that the Haredim are the have the greatest percentage of volunteers in the Israeli population. So I wonder whether if you were to take the actual hours that they volunteer throughout their life, not just during wartime, you might find that they're currently doing what's effectively a national service.
You seem to be a very positive person. would that be accurate? Am I portraying you properly?
Yeah, my wife used to say to me, she said, you know, why do you have to reframe everything? She
said, and you do reframe a lot into I'll tell you, you know, one of the things that we, as thank God, parents and spouses who've never suffered the way you have, one of the things we were shocked was your reaction to whether you should or should not harbor hate for those who killed your daughters and wife. Mm-hmm. And it seemed that you were thinking in the direction that you do not hate these people, and that you have a softer view of their... How would you put it?
Look, I said, look, I don't care if the army finds them and kills them. I mean, if they're a danger to the population, obviously that's a mitzvah.
It's a requirement.
But from my perspective, it's not going to give me any nechama to know that they were killed, unless, you know, as it happens, they were planning another attack, and therefore Tzahal eliminated them. But in terms of hate, I've thought about this a lot. I think that, you know, the question is, what's the opposite to happiness? And it's not sadness, because I'm happy and sad all the time now. And if they were opposites, I couldn't do both. So I think to myself, you know, mitzvah gedol liyob simcha tamid. So it's a mitzvah always to be happy. And yet it's also a mitzvah to be sad at a levaya or at on Tisha B'Av. So how is it that Chazal could tell us to be happy and sad if there are contradictions? So it seems to me that there's one thing that Chazal said you're not allowed to feel, which is anger, right? That Rambam says that you're not allowed to feel anger. So what if the opposite to happy is angry, which is sort of feeling of hate? Right. And I feel that that's probably true for me, that, you know, I cannot be happy and angry. And if I have a choice, you know, I prefer to get rid of the anger and have a bit more happiness, because I really need as much as I can get.
Would your children, who, thank God, are still with you, would they agree with you?
Yes, I don't think that they've been angry. They've been, you know, getting on with their lives and trying to rebuild. We've been trying together to rebuild a family, which is a challenge. One of the challenges is that I saw a psychological report a few years ago that having four daughters is the best combination. They get on the best out of any combination. And having two is the worst. The two daughters fight. And my daughters went from four to two. And so it's been, you know, it's probably not too many cases of that having happened in history. But they're struggling with that relationship now because...
But they remain. And so, they are the...
Yeah, but and the connections between them have changed because it used to be four of them, now it's two, and you know, that is...
Do they tire of hearing about the episode from a year ago? Like, is it difficult for them? And when you say move on, is part of that trying not to focus so much on what happened?
Interestingly, they've been asked more and more to speak about it, and I think they find it therapeutic now to speak about it, probably more difficult at the beginning. My son... has not wanted to talk about it from the beginning, and now he will avoid any discussion about it. And if you met him, you wouldn't know anything had happened to him.
Is he able to move on? Is he pursuing things?
Baruch Hashem, he's moving on. He's in boarding school, and he's got a lot of friends. And
Wow. Back to the Aliyah for a moment, if we may, and we talk about the dangers on the college campuses, etc. It's interesting that you visit the United States and come up with a plan that you propose for communities to move, etc. My fear, and by the way, this might be your fear, you're just being practical. Mm-hmm. My fear is that the speed with which it might happen this time could make the World War II era, Rebbetzin Jungreis's era, look like, you know, a lengthy period of time, a lengthy era. Mm-hmm. In that case, a community initiative may not even be helpful, frankly.
Right, right. That's something which I fear, which is why I think they need to have an emergency Aliyah plan. I've said to every place I spoke, every shul, everybody should have an emergency Aliyah plan as a family. They should sit around the table with their loved ones who are the reason they're not currently making Aliyah in the next month, and they should decide where would we go, how many units would we need, how would we cater for grandma, grandpa, how would we cater for Chaimi in high school and Devorah in college. What would be our plans? Because even if you don't think you're going to need them now, it could be that when you do need them, you'll need them very quickly. So why not think about it, get some prices, maybe. And the other thing I said was, Americans spend $50,000, $100,000 a year on health insurance.
Right.
Right. Why do you spend that? Because there's a 1 in 1,000 chance, God forbid, you'll get $1 million, $5 million bill for some sort of illness. I said, if you think there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that America will not be a place for you to live in the next year, 3, 5, or for your children, you need to have an insurance policy. And that might not be 1 in 1,000, might be 1 in 100 or 1 in 10. So I think that Jews all over the world should be thinking about what their insurance policy is for this.
Right. And you didn't even mention in this conversation the cost of education in Israel, which I don't know if you're familiar with what's going on in the United States.
Right. You're being priced out. I mean, right. I think Hashem has given you subtle hints over the past.
And he's done it in a positive way.
In a positive way.
Through money instead of, God forbid, through loss of life.
Yeah, but those, those who notice that and take the message react, and those who don't, unfortunately, stay behind, and then the messages get tougher each time. I mean, one of the things that worries me, which, is one scenario, but I'm sure there are a million scenarios, if China were to attack Taiwan, in the next few months, which is not beyond the realm of possibility, that will crash the stock market, probably collapse the dollar, probably collapse the housing markets in America. And who knows whether American Jews will be able to afford to make Aliyah at that point. So this is something that could happen literally within a month or five.
Wow. You live in what I often call a hybrid neighborhood. You're in Efrat. So you're in what many would consider a pretty rough area of Israel, meaning that you're surrounded by a lot of interesting other neighborhoods. All right, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, you're in one of the, I would say, most secure Jewish neighborhoods of Harei Yehuda, right? I think we could talk. Mm-hmm. Has your attitude, and I don't know what your attitude was pre-October 7th, you could brief us on that. Mm-hmm. Has your attitude toward living with our neighborly cousins changed pre and post October the 7th?
Not really, because we look at Palestinians as individuals because we actually encounter them on a day-to-day basis, or at least before the 7th of October. So I actually had friends, or at least people who worked in the home and who I knew for many years, and I would ask about their family. They would ask about my family. I would trust them to work at home, with my kids there and my wife there with a chainsaw in the garden. So I have no problem with these people. They're mensches. Some of them I trust more than some Jewish workmen that I know. And I'm actually in contact with them still, and every chag they send me a chag sameach, and I send them a Ramadan Mubarak. So you know, when you know people individually, you don't fear them in the same way. And we've got some very nice, you know, Arab villages around us where the people are extremely pleasant, and you know, they would like to see an end to this, you know, as much as we would. They'd like to see an end to Hamas, you know, more than we would. They probably want to see the end of the Palestinian Authority more than we would. So you know, these people also want to have a good life.
What scares me, and I'm sure you've thought of this, is that we know October 7th, there was a lot of information, and in some cases, actual violence perpetrated by those who've been in those Jewish homes in that area.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things that I look at is that, you know, I used to say I live in Judea and Samaria, right? Because if you say you live in the West Bank, apparently that's sort of a negative statement. I'm now prepared to say I am a settler in the West Bank. Why? Because I believe that someone who's living in Tel Aviv and someone who's living in Haifa is also a settler in the West Bank. Because what we've discovered is our enemy considers Tel Aviv to be the West Bank. And they just
them to be settlers.
Yeah, and them to be settlers. So we're all settlers and we're all living in the West Bank. So I think what we saw from October the 7th is that, you know, that there is no distinction actually between where I live and Tel Aviv. Actually, we get less missiles. That's the only difference.
Right. That's a good point, actually. Rabbi Leo D is with us. All right, so it's that part of the conversation where I have to ask you about the future. I mean, what do you think? I don't know how you view Israel politically. I don't even know if you've made any major statements about that in the last year, about the Israeli government and how they handle things. One would have to assume that in order to continue to rebuild from October to 7th, there has to be effective leadership at some point, you know, coming out of the Knesset. What do you think about the future of Israel?
I think that Israelis are agreed upon one thing, which is that we have to finish the job, because we have 60,000 people who can't go back to their homes in the north of Israel. I think we have a number of who can't go back to their homes in the south of Israel. And I can't believe many people believe that we could actually have any sort of ceasefire. We actually have to finish the job. We have to finish off Hamas. We have to finish off Hezbollah, and probably have to finish off the threat from Iran. So we're united in that sense. And, you know, unfortunately, the media, as you know, focuses on, you know, one story. So you see people marching in Tel Aviv, and it looks like it's, you know, it's 50% of the population. In fact, it's about 1%. So there's very small numbers of people who actually, you know, might have a different view at this point. And the number is so much smaller than it was before the 7th of October. Right. So things have actually got much better in terms of, you know, Jewish unity, our commitment for, you know, for change. And, you know, whilst, you know, people's views of Bibi, you know, have fluctuated, you know, both in my community and outside. It's clear that he is strong enough to stand up to American presidents, because he's proven that in the past. And actually what we see is that that might be a skill set which is pretty valuable at the moment. So
he'll certainly continue to try to convince us of that. I'll tell you.
I think the fact that he's threatening to go to Congress to make a speech, I think Biden might be a little bit sort of worried about that and might, you know, behave a little bit more, might be a bit more in order. Knowing that, you know, he could do an Obama.
Understood. What do you think of the political turmoil in your old home country?
It's very interesting. The defense minister in Britain, a guy called Grant Shapps, stood up and made a speech a couple of months ago where he said Britain needs three things. Number one, spending more money on military. Number two, conscription. And number three, a change in culture. And if you unpack that, it's fascinating, because if Britain would spend more money on military, right, they'd spend less on healthcare. And as we know, the British healthcare system is the biggest cost. And Israel has the most economic healthcare system in the world. So effectively, they'd have to adopt an Israeli healthcare system. So they'd have to become more like Israel. Israel is the only Western country that has conscription for men and women.
Right.
So by saying we're going to have conscription, it means we have to be more like Israel. And then he said change in culture, and it wasn't clear what he meant until a week later they did a survey, and they asked Gen Z how many would like to join the army, and 27% said yes. So he's looking at Israel and saying, you know, how is it you've got all your youth to volunteer, and the reservists, 120% came when you expected 100% or 60%. So the change in culture is, can we be more like Israel? So everybody's looking at us, not just Britain, also Europe, also America, and they're saying, how can we be more like Israel? We are all a goyim now like we've never been before.
Wow, what an observation. I'm glad I asked you about your home country, because that's an unbelievable observation. All right, so the message is very simple. The future of the Jewish people is in the state of Israel, And as Bibi might put it, because I think he was basically saying it this way on another topic back in Chol HaMoed Sukkos at the UN, as he would say, hop on the train now because you don't want to miss the train. It's about to leave the station, and God forbid it leaves us back in the United States in a difficult situation.
Well, I'll tell you something. I was planning to have another trip to the States mid-June. I looked at flights. There are no flights out of Israel mid-June.
To go to the New York, New Jersey area?
To go to the New York, New Jersey area. And maybe if I paid $2,000 each way, I could get a flight that takes me in, you know, late on Sunday and gets me out sort of early on Wednesday or something. But I can't do my usual night flight business and get 4 days.
You're sounding like us Americans now, complaining about the airline prices.
But there's nothing flying at the moment. It's completely it's sold out.
Unbelievable. Can you get into a car without thinking of your wife and daughters?
I think about my wife and daughters every minute of every day. So,
but being on the road has to be. It's not an enhanced experience.
You know what? I mean, I've actually driven past the route that we went up that fateful day. The first time was very challenging, and the second time was much easier. And now I don't think about it at all. So, I say to people, you know, the challenge for me was to get to a point where I could remember my wife and daughters with a smile, because you know everything reminds me of them around the house, wherever I go, people I speak to. And if I can't get to that point, then I just couldn't live. So, Baruch Hashem, that's what I'm working on.
You've taught us a lot of lessons today, and I appreciate it very much. And I'm honored that you spent all this time with us.
I'm honored to be asked.
Thank you very much. Rabbi Leo D, Tadar Rabba.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Rabbi Leo D, in a landmark conversation for us, in my opinion, here on JM in the AM.